This CKNW podcast is brought to you by Destination Toyota in Burnaby, your neighborhood Toyota store.
It's time now for the investigators. And on this edition, we are looking at one of the issues that isn't getting a lot of attention, let's say, during this campaign. And we've been kind of focusing on that over the last week or so. But this time it is BC's most vulnerable children and youth. Now, we heard a little bit about that earlier from the group Civil Rights Now. But Bob Mackin joins us now to talk about the reports of violence and injuries suffered by workers at the Maples Adolescent Treatment Center in Burnaby. And we are talking about a serious problem here that needs fixing. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
All right. So what did you dig up?
Well, the Maples is in Burnaby. It opened in 1969. It's operated by the Ministry of Children and Family Development. It's a three-building complex off Willingdon. It's near BCIT. It has 22 beds. It's a treatment facility for 12 to 17-year-olds for psychiatric and behavioral problems. These are youth with serious issues, youth affected by fetal alcohol syndrome, developmental disabilities, mental illness, physical and or sexual violence, and even drug addiction. Last year, the Maples served about 200 youth. The average stay was between 1 and 3 months. And according to the ministry, there's supposed to be one frontline staffer for every two youths, a shift supervisor, a psychiatric nurse essentially, for every four staff, plus a shift supervisor for each residential unit, about 10 people on duty. Last year, the budget to run the place was $9.14 million. The Union of Psychiatric Nurses is very clear. They don't want to demonize the patients there, the clients. They're there because they have problems with their lives. The Union of Psychiatric Nurses says that the situation there, the staffing is not enough. That is the big issue. Staff there work in fear of violence, and they say that youths aren't getting the best care that they should get.
Okay, so what kind of proof do they have of that?
Well, reports that I obtained via Freedom of Information said that for the first 11 months of 2012, there were 56 client-on-staff incidents of violence that were reported, and then there were 30 incidents of client-on-client violence. And reports also indicate separately other documents I got that there were three more client-on-staff incidents in December for a total of 59 in 2012. And that is after a couple of years of declines. There were 39 client-on-staff and 45 client-on-client incidents reported in 2009. And again, the numbers fell in 2010 and 2011, but they went up in 2012. Now, the ministry, when I asked them, they blamed the 2012 increase on, quote, one or two very challenging youth, end quote. And they claimed to be unaware that some of the incidents were falling through the cracks. Now, the BC Nurses Union complained, and in March 2011, 2 years ago, WorkSafe BC issued a damning report, and WorkSafe found that violent incidents were not sufficiently explored, documented, or communicated, and actions arising from them were inadequate. There was not enough done to reduce the risk or minimize the violence, particularly in a unit that's called Crossroads. That's where there may be as many as five residents at any time, the government tells me. Five residents at any time who may be deemed unfit to stand trial or who are not criminally responsible because of a mental disorder. And there were 22 incidents, it said in the WorkSafe report, in 2010 that produced 26 injuries to staff. And only 10 to 15% of incidents, this is one of the most troubling areas, only 10 to 15% of incidents they found in this report in 2011 were actually properly documented and analyzed. So a lot of things were falling through the cracks and not being documented, because if you don't document it, you don't figure out ways and means of correcting it. And the Joint Management Union Health and Safety Committee, it missed four meetings for that year, and three of the meetings it missed were in a row. This is the union and management committee that's supposed to meet on a monthly basis to review problems and come up with solutions.
How is this even possible, Bob? I mean, what you're listing there, all these incidents that are not being reported properly, but they know they're happening. How is this possible?
Well, the union says that they're so busy trying to do the frontline work that they're not able to do all the documenting work that they want to do. They say there's just not enough time, not enough people around. And via another FOI request to WorkSafe BC, WorkSafe BC told me that it had no records for 2007 to 2009 of incident reports. So they had lots of records for the years 2010 to 2012, but they told me they had none for the years 2007 to 2009.
Like zero.
Zero, and I've complained to the Information and Privacy Commissioner's office. There's a file open there.
Okay, so tell me about some of the worst incidents here.
Well, there were three post-Christmas incidents in 2012, one of which, on Boxing Day, a patient grabbed a worker around the neck and stated, and this is the quote from the report, quote, I'm going to choke you till you're blue. On December 28th, there were two incidents. One agitated youth lunged at a worker in the staff office, punched her in the head. Later in that day, a patient turned and began punching a worker, quote, numerous times in the head. And there were two of the worst incidents were back in 2011, around the time when they were trying to figure out what was happening, and WorkSafe was starting to take notice of the maples. A May 17, 2011 report said that there were three workers injured when a patient charged at a worker with fists drawn, punched a worker twice in the face, smashed a worker's head against the wall, and threw a computer at another worker. And then there was another one on September 13, 2011, where three workers were assaulted by the same aggressor from that May incident. Two of them were punched in the face several times, and the other's head was banged against the wall. And again, these produced several injuries, facial head injuries, upper body injuries. So some of these people had extensive periods of time off work. Now, I did talk with the Union of Psychiatric Nurses, their health and safety chair, Prentice Geary, who you'll hear first in this clip, and then the president, Dan Murphy, near the end. And they say that the legacy of those 2011 attacks remains.
The patient involved had a history of violence directed towards staff, to the best of my knowledge. We still have a member off on leave from this incident, and this incident took place nearly 2 years ago. So, and this person was responding to protect another staff member. So there was more than one staff member attacked in that attack. The one staff member was severely injured, and it could have been killed had our member not intervened. And our member is still off due to the psychological impact of that incident. So if you look at the long-term effects of having inappropriate staff levels, you know, what is the cost? Here we've got this nurse who may never return to practice because of she was traumatized by that incident, not only by her firsthand experience, but also the vicarious trauma of witnessing her colleague being brutally attacked. And she wasn't even the person that was primarily attacked. She was the person who jumped in to defend the other staff member. Yeah. So this just shows you it's not always just the physical injuries heal. It's the long-lasting effects of the psychological trauma as a result, the post-traumatic stress that the staff members are under, and also, for that instance, the patients that observed the attack as well. Yeah. And that's something I think as a system that we don't do a good enough job of, is looking at what are the impacts, the far-reaching impacts. Do we do the critical incident debriefing like we really should be doing? You know, there's a process that management says they do, but are we really looking at everyone who saw the incident, including the patients? Because that's traumatic for them to see this happen.
I defy anybody to go on in there and spend a couple weeks and then say, how do you enjoy your time with your children? Did you feel, how'd you sleep last night after you saw somebody get the hell beat out of them and you watched your coworkers get beat up too? You know, did you go home and sleep? I mean, everybody down there goes through one form of post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, we might not go through, you know, we couldn't be diagnosed with it, but we go through it. You don't sleep after you go home. You might get 2 hours of sleep and then wake up. Then you got to get up and take your kids to school and all that and then go back to work. It's not fun.
No, I can imagine it's not, but I guess the question becomes, what are we doing about it?
That's right. That was Union of Psychiatric Nurses President Dan Murphy, and before him, the Health and Safety Chair, Prentice Geary. They want more staff, essentially, better training, because they are in a situation where they're caregivers, but they're being asked essentially to be security guards when these kinds of incidents happen, and they say they don't have the skill sets to do both.
Bob Mackin is with us. We're talking about, in particular, vulnerable children and youth and the role in this election. Okay, Bob, you've been talking about the Maples.
Yeah, the Maples in Burnaby, the Adolescent Treatment Center there, that's the province-wide one. The frontline workers are scared to go public. There's no whistleblower law. They fear being fired, but I did find two spoke on the condition of anonymity to me. They said that staff are there to offer therapy, but sometimes they have to restrain clients. They're caregivers, not security guards. They're not equipped to offer that service. They don't have anyone there, and that's part of the problem. The solution by those that are in power there. They have what's called the attachment theory, and that's where, in a nutshell, that a caregiver and patient have a relationship. It's meant to simulate a parent-child relationship, but this one does not have boundaries or discipline attached. And both the people I did talk to were off the job for extended periods because of being victims of violence at the workplace, and they needed surgery for their injuries. One even suffered post-traumatic stress disorder. And her quote to me was, these kids run the place. The staff don't. We just herd them from one place to the next and hope not to get hit on a daily basis, end quote. And it was described to me that youths are often taken to McDonald's and movies. There is even a smoking area on the grounds. They don't get punished for destroying TVs or furniture or even for harming staff. Another worker said that each child's history file he read, and about how they got there, how they got to the Maples, how they got to be in an unfortunate condition with their lives, and it was emotionally draining. And he said that the attachment theory that they use, that's not perfect, but it's the best thing they have for now to try to change these lives, these young lives. And he said the typical client that he faced was about 13 to 15 years old, low income, predominantly white. They frequently change schools, and they either came from a single parent household or both of their parents were on social assistance. And he described the incidents that he was often spat on or stabbed with a pencil, and he found a resident suffering from self-inflicted cutting wounds on a number of occasions. There are escapes and suicide attempts. And he said that staff can't show emotion or pass judgment. It would that would harm the goals of the attachment theory. He also mentioned that there's misdiagnosis of mental health medication, and there's also the abuse of street drugs being evident among some of the patients, that there's also cases of drug-induced psychosis. That's not uncommon there. And he said that some youths would even sleep in their daytime clothes, the ones that are newer in the facility. They sleep in their daytime clothes and even wet their beds on purpose. They had been assaulted so many times before coming to the Maples, and they use that as a habit for self-protection. These are some very fragile and vulnerable lives that do need help. And he said that some residents of the Maples do go on to live normal lives, turn things around, and become useful members of society, but others just end up in streets or in jail because of all the problems they face. And again, I talked with Union of Psychiatric Nurses President Dan Murphy, and he discusses the challenge of dealing with these lives.
You have youth that maybe feel alcohol, or just what goes with use is very poor impulse control. They're also having to impress the other youth that are there. They're having it, well, they have to create their own safety zone, and that can be by being a tough kid, showing that they're tough. Also, we represent, in a lot of cases, for the youth that are there, authority. And these kids are there because they don't respect authority, or they've been abused by the people that were the authority figures in their lives. And they're systemic of a poorly managed facility, which is always comes down to dollars and cents. In the last 7-8 years, the problems have gotten really, really bad at all these facilities because the diversity of problems has increased. We're coming in with new drugs that the kids are taking out on the streets. The problems with families are getting to be a lot more complicated, and the crimes are becoming far more violent. So when we get these kids in, it's not a simple, you know, you had a breakdown in your family, you don't have a parent or whatever, and you're angry. We're dealing with a kid that could be on meth, could be on heroin. They could have been completely, and in most cases were, completely traumatized by their family, you know, their family makeup. They may have been severely raped if it's a girl or a boy. They may have been exposed to extreme violence, everything that would be abnormal in a family, a lot of these kids have experienced. So then you bring them in, and there's very little resources to throw at them as far as working with them therapeutically. There's basically, there would be, you know, for instance, Prentice or I, we'd go in there as the nurses and we'd have a few healthcare workers, but the amount of hours that we would get to actually engage these kids and sit down with them and develop a trusting relationship is minimal. A lot of it is just contain and control and document. And it's ridiculous because that's not what they need. They actually need to be engaged and dealt with.
Back in 1994, the Maples was known back then. This has got a long history. A 12-year-old girl named Serena Fry was found hanged to death in the Maples. She'd been sexually assaulted on an unsupervised pass, and the coroner classified that death as undetermined. Her father complained to a legislative committee several years later that that the NDP government of the day covered it up because they wouldn't release the files through Freedom of Information. No charges were laid in that. Also in 1994, Judge Thomas Gove investigated the whole system. That was after the death of Matthew Vaudrey, and a legacy of Judge Thomas Gove's 1995 published report was the creation of the Ministry of Child and Family Development. A decade later, under the Gordon Campbell Liberals in 2005, Ted Hughes reviewed the ministry. He found it was, quote, stretched far beyond its means, end quote. There was a climate of instability and confusion and a revolving door of management under the Liberals at the time. And from 1995 to 2005, there had been 9 ministers and 8 deputy ministers.
Hey, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Say that again. So over a 10-year period from 1995 to 2005, there were 9 different ministers in charge?
That's right. That was the last 4 or 5 years of the NDP in the 90s and the first 4 years of the Liberals in the 2000s. 9 ministers, 8 deputy ministers. Not much has changed. The revolving door continues. There's been 5 children and family ministers in the last 6 years. Stephanie Cadieux is the latest. She did not respond to my request for an interview. Before her, Mary Polak, Mary McNeil, Tom Christensen, the late Stan Hagen, even Christy Clark, our current premier. She was minister back in 2004 after Gordon Hogue, who was the one-time director of the Willingdon Youth Detention Center. Now, the 2006 Hughes Report, the legacy of that was the creation of the Representative for Children and Youth. Mary Ellen Turple-LaFond was appointed back then. Her latest report, it's called Still Waiting, was released a week before the election writ was dropped. She called the youth mental health system in BC fractured and a patchwork. She said there are year-long waits for youth to see a mental health professional or to get treatment. And her quote in the report was, "It is confusing for youth, their families, and even the professionals who serve them, and therefore actually getting the required services is often near to impossible." She said that essentially BC has a plan, but it lacks leadership. So she actually recommended creating a Minister of State for Youth Mental Health. And none of the parties has really adopted that yet. They said that's a good idea that they'll think about, but no adoption of that.
Okay, very quickly, let's sum up then what the party platforms do say about this.
Well, for the Liberals, they're in power, and their budget this year for children and family development, $1.3 billion. More than that, a third of that is for child safety, family support, and children care services. Back in 2005, was $1.5 billion, and that was when it included Community Living BC. The 2013-14 budget, the key expenditures there are almost $79 million for child and youth mental health services and a little more than $46 million for youth justice services. That was cut by $260,000 from youth justice over the last year. That's blamed on a federal cutback. And mental health services was boosted by a very small $140,000.
Okay.
The Liberal platform, it says, they want to create one-stop access to practical advice and support for family support services, children and youth mental health and special needs. Essentially, what they want to do is more efficiency with what exists.
All right, the NDP?
That seems to be the most solid plan, however vague the plans are, of any of the platforms. It promises to increase frontline staff and enhance treatment and outreach services for children and youth, and, quote, renew funding for a community action initiatives to provide mental health and addiction outreach services, end quote. They've costed that out to $24 million for the ministry over 3 years. That would also include hiring 130 social workers.
Okay.
And then for the Conservatives and Greens, Conservatives say they want efficient and affordable mental health and addiction initiative, and the Greens provide increased support to parents and families impacted by mental illness.
And that's it for those two parties, just those lines?
That's it.
Okay, I can see what you're saying then about that. All right, Bob, thanks very much. Where can people get in touch with you?
Indeed. They can go to the cknw.com website, click on the Investigators link. You can connect with me on Facebook, go to the Investigators 980, or find me on Twitter, Bob Mackin, B-O-B-M-A-C-K-I-N.